Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How good a president was Ronald Reagan? 20 years after his final day in office, the 40th president is seen as a visionary hero by many Americans who remember him as an enemy of big government, a fan of tax cuts, and an instrumental figure in the end of the Cold War. Reagan is frequently praised by GOP political candidates and quoted by pundits. Even many loyal Democrats have adopted his rhetoric about the value of tax cuts in a severely strained economy. But my guest today argues much of the conventional wisdom about Ronald Reagan is rooted in half-truths and points out that while he was actually in office, Reagan's approval ratings were just slightly above average. Pulitzer Prize winner Will Bunch is senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and the author of the paper's Attitude blog. His new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. Will, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me on.
How would you define the legacy of Ronald Reagan as it exists in American culture today?
Well, he's certainly become this iconic figure. You know, one of the things that inspired the book was the success of something called the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project, which I'm pretty sure you've seen some of the effects of actually in Texas, which is this effort to name roads and other public edifices for Ronald Reagan all over the country. The actual stated goal of the project is they would like to see something renamed or renamed for Ronald Reagan in every one of all of the 3,067 counties in the United States. So there's that legacy. But, I mean, I think the broader purpose of the people promoting this legacy of Ronald Reagan is to have a continuing influence over our politics today. And, you know, you mentioned a couple times in your introduction about the whole issue of tax cuts and I mean, clearly that's been by far and away the most dramatic thing we've seen recently in the sense of this debate over how to turn around the American economy. And the Republican position is basically rooted in their version of the philosophies of Ronald Reagan, which is that the only thing that ever improves the economy is a tax cut, basically. And even though we're confronted with evidence that economic evidence that spending and actual stimulus creates new jobs at a much greater clip than tax cuts does, number one. And number two, I mean, one of the motivations of this whole stimulus package that we've been debating is not just to create jobs, although that's the biggest goal, but also to undo some of the legacy of neglect of the last 25 or 30 years. You know, we have a crumbling infrastructure in this country. We've totally ignored doing anything about alternative energy, solar, wind power. We've ignored our mass transit system, and this bill was an attempt to rectify that. But I think you saw the virulence of some of the opposition, and it was rooted in the ideas of Ronald Reagan, who, in fact, while he did push through a massive tax cut in his first year in office, and particularly one that benefited the highest tax brackets, he actually was more pragmatic, I think, than today's Republicans in that he also then carried through a series of tax increases to try and undo some of the effects of that first tax cut that had actually gone too far. We don't really see that kind of pragmatism today.
Was there a lot of resistance from the working class to Reagan's tax policies while he was in office?
Not so much. And I think that's deeply rooted in kind of the American politics of that era, which was still kind of the most heated portion of what we've come to call the culture wars that kind of started in the 1960s. Ronald Reagan did very well with middle-class voters because he kind of tapped into their resentment over 60s-era protests and the civil rights movement, affirmative action and some of the programs of the 70s. And I think voters in the middle class looked to him for those things, and I think as far as the economy was concerned, they didn't like the way the economy had gone during the 70s under Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. We had the condition known as stagflation, which was high inflation and high unemployment at the same time. You know, we had what at the time was unprecedented increases in gasoline prices because of the Arab fuel embargoes and that sort of thing. So I think as far as the economics, they were willing to give him a chance. Unfortunately, what happened is actually, for all the hailing of Reagan's tax-cutting prowess, middle-class taxpayers actually had a larger tax bite at the end of Reagan's presidency. And the main reason why is because there was a big increase in payroll taxes to deal with looming problems in Social Security that Reagan signed off on in 1983. And payroll taxes are a tax that has a much bigger bite on the middle class than these taxes that affect the wealthy, like capital gains taxes and other taxes that have been cut by Republicans over the last generation.
Reagan famously said, of course, that rather than solving our problems, government was the problem. Can you talk about how the size of the federal government changed over the course of Reagan's presidency?
The short answer is that it increased. I say that in several different measures. I mean, it certainly increased in terms of government spending, increased dramatically during the Reagan years. Now, a lot of that was concentrated in the Pentagon, but the reason that you had such a problem with deficits while Reagan was president was because he increased Pentagon spending by so much.
And the scope of government did change, particularly in terms of regulatory activity.
Yes, that did increase. I mean, obviously, you saw the federal government is a large, it's a large animal and it's got lots of different components. He certainly did cut aids to cities, and he certainly started on the era of cutting back in regulations. I think the best known example of that, which has become kind of a footnote in history, but maybe it shouldn't be, is the savings and loan scandal. Very early in his presidency, Reagan pushed through a major deregulation of the S&L industry. In fact, my recollection is that had a pretty big impact in Texas, that there were a number of savings and loans in your part of the country that went under during the late 1980s. Because of this poorly thought out deregulation, there were a lot of bad loans, a lot of insider dealing, a lot of corruption that led a number of these S&Ls to collapse. And instead of learning, and that's a lesson that, first of all, cost the American taxpayer an estimated $150 billion back then, which would have been more in today's dollars. But also, it was a lesson that we failed to learn as we continued to deregulate the financial industry right through the present crisis. So there was that. One other thing I just want to say about Reagan and the size of government, he actually also increased the government payroll from 2.8 to 3 million while he was president. He added another cabinet department, the Department of Veteran Affairs, which actually I think was probably a good idea, but he'd run promising to reduce the number of federal agencies, and in fact, he increased them. So, and small government is just considered part of his legacy, and in practice, he wasn't really a small government person at all.
Will Bunch is my guest. His new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. How actively involved was Reagan himself in grooming his own legacy?
Not very, in the sense of, he left the presidency in 1989 and, did spend a few years campaigning for Republican causes, but also was, he was in his late 70s, even early 80s by then, and kind of stayed out of the public eye. And then in 1994, announced to the world that he was suffering from Alzheimer's disease, which by the way, he did, with enormous grace and class. So he lived on for another 10 years, totally out of the public eye because of his Alzheimer's. And it was actually, interestingly, it was during that time that you had a group of conservative activists who'd come to Washington during the so-called Reagan Revolution of the 1980s, who really launched this conscious effort that I talked about earlier in the interview, the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project, to try and. In an organized way, reshape the legacy of Ronald Reagan, which really was kind of suffering during the 90s. A lot of what Bill Clinton did as president when he came into office was aimed at kind of undoing Reaganomics, particularly the push to bring the federal government back into balance, which he finally succeeded by the end of the presidency. And the impact on the economy of that, in terms of lower interest rates and in terms of job creation, was just unprecedented. We saw a much stronger, healthier economy during the 90s than we did during Reagan's 80s, and I think a lot of that was actually not because of Reaganomics, but it was because of what was needed to undo Reaganomics.
Well, and it was part of that early optimism about the Clinton years that partially caused people like Grover Norquist to take on this legacy of Reagan. Can you talk about sort of what the genesis was of that? And as you mentioned, it came with an element of surprise. No one really expected them to come along and try to revive Reagan's legacy at that point.
Right, or even stealth, because they didn't make a big announcement. They didn't have a huge press conference to announce that we're doing this Ronald Reagan Legacy Project. I mean, they kind of rolled it out as a a little mini project of Grover Norquist's main group, which is called Americans for Tax Reform. Now, this started in 1997, and it started just months after Bill Clinton had been reelected to his second term as president. He had destroyed Bob Dole in the 1996 election, and Dole had tried to run as kind of a Reagan Republican. He called for a program of tax cuts that, you know, really, you know, despite the myth, I mean, was not basically supported by the American people. The American people were actually, according to most polls that were taken during the 90s, were quite happy to see the deficit paid down. I mean, they were hoping that the government would be developing perhaps a surplus that could be used to deal with our Social Security problem long-term and some of these other problems. So so as Clinton started his second term, I mean, the Republican movement, the conservative movement in this country was really kind of at a low ebb. I mean, they didn't have any charismatic leaders like a Ronald Reagan on the horizon, and they didn't really have any ideas for pushing their program forward. So, you know, so since they were having such a hard time looking to the future, they decided to look to the past. They decided that by, you know, installing Reagan as this iconic figure, and by developing candidates and ideas that would be motivated by the ideas of this Ronald Reagan who'd saved America during the 1980s, that this would be a formula to bring conservatives back into power. And as we all know, it essentially worked. I mean, you know, George W. Bush, you know, actively courted the endorsement of Grover Norquist and his allies when he started running for president in the late 1990s, during the same period that the Ronald Reagan presidency was getting Ronald Reagan Legacy Project was getting rolling. And George W. Bush really fashioned himself, you know, not as the son of George H.W. Bush, but as kind of an adopted son of Ronald Reagan. You know, when he was asked about Supreme Court appointees, he said he'd appoint Supreme Court justices like Ronald Reagan, not the two that his own father had appointed. And he made a tax cut that was very Reagan-esque in its approach. It became part of the centerpiece of his whole campaign. Even, again, as I noted earlier, I mean, public opinion polls showed that the public was not in favor of this tax cut plan, but Bush was determined to push this through, and he actually kind of surprised people when, in his early months of his presidency in 2001, when he did just that with kind of a surprising endorsement from Alan Greenspan, that he was able to get this large tax cut pushed through in the early months of his presidency.
Did Reagan effectively set George H.W. Bush up to fail?
That's an interesting. No one's put it to me that way before. That's an interesting way of putting at it. Kind of in a way, he, you know, you almost could say he did actually. And I'll, and the reason I say that is because, you know, Reagan really was a great communicator. I mean, with the help of his speechwriters, he produced some amazing rhetoric during his presidency. You know, the Tear Down This Wall speech, which inspired the title of the book, Tear Down This Myth, and some other addresses like his famous D-Day, 40th anniversary of D-Day speech in Normandy. I think what Republicans like Bush failed to recognize, though, was that there was a difference between Reagan's rhetoric and the way he actually governed. He actually governed as more pragmatically and as a compromiser, and That lesson of Ronald Reagan just totally sailed over the head of Bush and the Bush administration, who pursued this Reaganist rhetoric and then pursued very rigid policies to match.
Will Bunch is my guest. He's a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and a Pulitzer Prize winner. His new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. We'll return to the conversation in a moment, and we welcome your calls to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. Will Bunch is my guest. He's a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and the author of its Attitude blog. His new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. As you mentioned earlier, Will, President Reagan was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and announced it publicly in 1994. Very few people would argue with the fact that he did so graciously. And clearly that was not a calculated thing. But I'm wondering if you can talk about the extent to which it was, if this is the right word, serendipitous, in that it paved the way for people who wanted to sort of remake his legacy to do so unchallenged because it seemed somehow untoward to criticize someone who was gravely ill.
Oh, absolutely, Chris. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, it's I'm not sure the exact word I'd use it. I mean, it was kind of a perfect storm, I guess. I mean, you had this kernel of an idea among conservatives that you know they could fashion Reagan as an ideal president, and then you had this situation where people who, you know, we're talking about the 1990s. I mean, Reagan's presidency was still a lot fresher in people's minds, and it had been a very divisive presidency. As you mentioned in your introduction to the show, I mean, his Reagan's approval ratings were really only average. I think his Gallup average approval rating was 52%, which meant for large portions of his presidency, he had a less than 50% approval rating. You know, he certainly was unpopular with certain groups in this country, such as African Americans, such as gay and lesbian Americans. You know, were not happy with Reagan's presidency. So you had people who still had bitter memories of the Reagan years, but you know, after the 1994 Alzheimer's diagnosis, after that diagnosis, it was very difficult for people to oppose, you know, when measures were introduced to honor Reagan. I mean, the first major one was right after the project started in 97. I think that fall, they introduced a bill in Congress to rename National Airport in Washington as Reagan National Airport, which, as your listeners probably know, of course, was successful. Some Democrats were asked about it, like Marion Barry, who was the mayor of Washington, D.C., and Geraldine Ferraro, you know, kind of shrugged and said, well, you know, we're not going to oppose this. You know, you have to remember this also happened right around the time that the Monica Lewinsky scandal was breaking for Bill Clinton. And, you know, he certainly didn't want to appear cruel by, you know, opposing certain honors for Ronald Reagan. In fact, there was an interesting dynamic of interplay between the Lewinsky scandal and kind of the tearing down of Bill Clinton as a person or his personality, and the pumping up of Ronald Reagan, who, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Ronald Reagan, his policies were very divisive, but, he was seen by the majority of Americans as a decent person, as a decent human being, who did bring a certain kind of style to the Oval Office. And when Bill Clinton was president, I mean, his policies were, for the most part, extremely popular, or certainly were popular with the majority of the American people because we were experiencing such economic prosperity and also peace on the international front during the 1990s. So you had this interplay. I mean, I think it really helped the interplay between Reagan's image and Bill Clinton and the Lewinsky scandal kind of helped to restore the equilibrium to the conservative movement, where they weren't able to take down the policies of a progressive administration, so they took down the personalities instead.
Is it fair to ascribe some genuine value to the way that Reagan made us feel about ourselves in terms of optimism and confidence, particularly when he first entered office and was such a foil to the Carter administration?
Yes. Yeah, I absolutely do believe that. And in fact, after I finished work on the book and after Barack Obama was elected president, I published an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times I basically said that there are certain lessons, including some positive lessons, that Obama should take from the early days of the Reagan presidency. And that was really the largest one, is that I think Reagan was right to portray the American people as an optimistic people like himself, and that we're kind of can-do problem solvers as a nation. And they don't want to hear the kind of pessimistic, kind of malaise driven message that Jimmy Carter had been delivering in the late 1970s. What I think is important, though, is an important distinction is that Reagan used that optimism to sell some ideas that were not good for America in the long run. A classic example would be energy policy. Energy policy had really been a hallmark of Jimmy Carter's presidency because of the Arab oil embargo and because of high gasoline prices. And Reagan accused Carter of practicing the politics of scarcity, and that basically it was kind of the precursor to the drill baby drill chance that we saw in the 2008 election. There's plenty of oil and we just need to be, and there's plenty of fuel and we just need to be smarter and more optimistic about finding it. And I think that's going to prove over the course of time to be kind of magical thinking that was very harmful to this country. I don't think you want to see a kind of mindless optimism, but I do think a certain kind of optimism could serve President Obama well if he takes this current economic crisis and say, I know things look dark now, but this is America. We've solved the Great Depression. We can solve this. And if he makes that his overarching tone, I think that would serve him well, just as I think that aspect of Reagan's presidency served him well. And I think that's a lot to do with why he won such a large re-election victory, Reagan did in 1984, which also was when the economy was doing its absolute best. So I do think there's value in an optimistic message. I think what we have to understand, though, is what are the policies that optimism is being used to sell?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Will Bunch is my guest. His new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. Let's speak to Terry in Fort Worth. Hi, Terry.
A question for Mr. Bunch.
Okay.
Hi, Terry. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Former National Review editor Joseph Sobran, of all people, agreed with you entirely that Reagan was primarily myth. For example, throughout the 80s, as you correctly point out, the size of government did grow. Reagan consented to a tax increase in 1982. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that you're trying to debunk another myth by stealth. You're trying to set up the idea that small government is a myth. Is that true? And if so, I'd like to hear some evidence for that.
In terms of the question, it's certainly a myth, as we discussed, the idea that Reagan shrunk the size of government. Do I think that small government is a myth? No, actually, I don't exactly. I think there are ways to shrink the size of government intelligently. And as I actually mentioned in the book, and he gets absolutely zero credit for this, but Bill Clinton is somebody who had a lot of success in this area. The exact opposite of Reagan, some people look at the Reagan example and say, well, you know, maybe the federal government is just such that it's impossible for anybody to shrink. In fact, government did shrink under the next two-term president, Bill Clinton. And what he did when he came into office was he created a task force called the Reinventing Government Task Force. He asked Al Gore to head this, and this was actually one of the major things that Gore did as vice president during Clinton's first term. And you saw a decrease in the federal payroll, and this was one of several factors that led the government to end up with a balanced budget and with budget surpluses near the end of Clinton's presidency. So I do think it's possible to intelligently reduce the size of government. That was really not, for all the lip service that Ronald Reagan paid to it, that obviously was not really the central part of his agenda.
I have an email from Shelley in Waxahachie who says, often I've heard it said that the economic prosperity during the Clinton years is a result of the policies of the Reagan years, based on the assumption that it takes several years to realize the benefits of economic policy change. Is this true, and if not, why?
No, I don't believe it is. And that was not the perception at the time. When Clinton came into office in 1993, the first year of his presidency, his main legislative priority was an economic package that really aimed to undo some of what we call Reaganomics. It aimed to try and get the budget more into balance. Some of that was done by increasing taxes on the top tax bracket. They had gone from 70% to 28% over the course of Reagan's presidency, and under Clinton they went back up to 39.6%, I believe. Today it's 35%. So And there were other tweaks as well. And when that package passed, Time magazine ran on its cover a picture of Ronald Reagan upside down, and the headline was something along the lines of undoing Reagan or reversing Reaganomics, and that was kind of the theme to the 1990s. Ditto, actually, with his own handpicked successor, George H.W. Bush, who went through this famous episode where he'd originally said, "Read my lips, no new taxes," and then in 1990 turned around and signed on with Congress a tax increase. This, too, was also aimed at dealing with the impact of Reaganomics, that the huge deficits that had been run up during the Reagan years were proving so harmful to the economy. They had a negative impact on interest rates, and they, when the economy began to slide into a recession around 1990-91, the Federal Reserve had a lot, and the government had a lot less power to act to ease the recession because of the Reagan deficit. So I really think the economic policies of Clinton that were aimed at a balanced budget, which did help lower interest rates permanently, or during that during the 90s anyway, was not a continuation of Reagan's policies. It was a reversal of Reagan's policies, and it had an extremely positive impact on the economy.
Was Reagan's presidency in any way sort of a response to the myth of the Kennedy presidency?
No, I think that's a good question. I'd have to actually maybe think about that a little more. I mean, it's not an issue that really came up when I was researching the book. I think it's one area where the conventional wisdom is pretty much on the money, that Reagan's success as a candidate was driven in such large measure by the failure of Jimmy Carter's presidency. And I say that when I say failure, I really mean primarily that the stylistic failure of Carter's presidency, as we just discussed. I mean, his failure to inspire the American people and his kind of dour nature and his lack of optimism, which was such a contrast to Reagan. The tragedy is that, Jimmy Carter had some very good policies. And to me, the example of what happened in energy policy is just so dramatic. There's been a lot of interesting talk recently of a story that didn't get a lot of attention at the time, which was that midway through his presidency, Ronald Reagan actually took off solar panels that Jimmy Carter had installed on the roof of the White House. And obviously, that's a very symbolic thing. But in both cases, really.
It was symbolic for Carter, and then yes, it was symbolic
right,
for Reagan.
Exactly. That's an excellent point. But, beyond the symbolism, I mean, the truth is that Jimmy Carter had made alternative energy a hallmark of his presidency. In his kind of much maligned malaise speech that he gave to the American people in 1979, there's a line in that speech where he says, from this moment forward, the United States will not import one more drop of oil than it imports today. Would that were so, because, I mean, not only would that had just numerous positive benefits on the U.S. economy, but I think it would have maybe avoided some of our foreign policy catastrophes we've seen in the Middle East. So I think it was very unfortunate that Reagan reversed those policies of Jimmy Carter. But I do think Carter's failings as a leader really paved the way. I mean, people were nervous about Reagan. They thought he was probably too conservative for this country. There was a lot of worries going into his presidency, which I think, proved to be completely unfounded. That he might be too prone to even a nuclear war. There was a lot of concerns about him having the nuclear football with him. When in fact, that was, I think, one of the most positives of Reagan's presidency, was that he was very anti-nuclear in the end. In terms of Kennedy, I think America may have wanted a charismatic leader as John F. Kennedy had been, even though you had one with radically different ideas. But maybe in that sense, I think it was almost wanting somebody who'd be a Kennedy-esque, like, glamorous figure in the White House.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Will Bunch is my guest. His new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. Let's go next to Richardson and speak to Ron. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I want to say it's a great show for President's Day, by the way. And, I a prior comment he was making, Molly Ivins, the late Molly Ivins, made a similar kind of observation that during Reagan's depositions on Iran-Contra, it was clear that he had was suffering some limited mental capacity, and the Democrats just backed off. You know, they were too nice, I guess, depending on your viewpoint. I just remember Studs Terkel complaining that he felt like he was living in a country with Alzheimer's before Reagan's diagnosis ever came out, because there seemed to be so much lack of recollection about misbehavior by the Republicans. And having now that I'm 55, I feel like I've almost, of course, I'm in Dallas, having a similar experience where they certainly seem to be going out of their way to make a saint out of a man who ran a dirty war in Nicaragua, Iran-Contra, tax credits for schools that discriminate on the basis of race, and his support for the apartheid government of South Africa. But I'd love to buy your guest a beer just to go over those. But I guess my observation is that the Republicans have made Reagan their hero because they don't have anybody else.
Yeah.
They don't have Nixon. Bush 1 just disappeared after he lost the election. It's like the commissar vanished. And W has suffered will suffer, I think, a worse fate. So Reagan's the only guy they've got. I mean, that's kind of my observation.
I'd love to take you up on that beer, although you can't actually, I won't be there, but you can buy the book, so that'll be the next best thing, I guess. But you made a couple of really good points. One, the first thing you mentioned about the problem with Reagan's memories, and that was, it's interesting, when we were talking earlier about how Reagan was perceived right after he left the presidency, when that deposition was released and people realized that he really had a lack of awareness the last couple of years what was going on in his own administration, and that was a very damaging thing.
We'll be back in just a minute with Will Bunch. He is the senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. His new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. You can join us as well by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Will Bunch is my guest. He's the senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. His new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. The caller before the break, Will, talked about how the Republicans perhaps needed Reagan because there was no other figure in contemporary American history within the party that sort of matched the ability to be lionized in such a way. Is it possible, does this all tell us that we can do this with almost any political figure after sufficient time has passed and if sufficient effort is applied?
Perhaps we could. I don't think it's quite been, well, let me qualify that. I mean, it's interesting when you look at the way that American presidents have been perceived through history. I mean, the perception's changed dramatically. I mean, there have been a lot of great stories just this week for the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln about how, you know, Lincoln's public image and our conceptions of Abraham Lincoln have just evolved and changed so dramatically back and forth over the last, 140 years since he was president. One thing, and I actually get into this a little bit in the book, Tear Down This Myth, is that a lot of the monuments and most epic memorializing of Abraham Lincoln didn't take place right after he died, but it really took place in the early 20th century, the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. In fact, I think the Lincoln Memorial was dedicated in the early 1920s. And it was driven by, like any myth or any kind of historical legacy. It was driven in large part by what was going on in the present. You know, you had massive foreign immigration to the United States in the early 20th century, and there was a lot of debate about what it means to be an American. And, you know, Lincoln had these frontier values. And so we did, one thing about Lincoln and his legacy is it was kind of nonpartisan. I mean, obviously he's a Republican, although it's interesting, you don't see today's Republicans being the ones really racing to embrace Abraham Lincoln so much, which I find interesting. But the Reagan myth, aside from the fact that it started while he was still alive, which I think is pretty unusual, was also just something that was really driven by bipartisan activists, and I think that really made it different, you know. One thing I thought that caller made an interesting point. Actually, I think the Republicans had a great role model president in the latter 20th century in Dwight Eisenhower, but some of the things that make him a role model don't fit the modern conservative agenda. I mean, the fact that he tried to warn people about the military-industrial complex in this country, you know, that doesn't certainly fit the modern Republican plan for America. So, so you don't see a Dwight Eisenhower becoming an icon the way that Ronald Reagan has.
In terms of omissions, when we remember Ronald Reagan in the way that many conservatives do today, you noted when you went to the Reagan Library, there's not a shred of documentation available to the public there about Iran-Contra.
Yeah, which is quite amazing. I mean, for those of us who lived through 1987 and 88, and 87 in particular, I guess, a lot of us thought that Iran-Contra might become the defining legacy of Reagan. It really did imperil his entire presidency. In fact, and this alludes a little bit to what we were talking about with the earlier caller, that I think Democrats in Congress kind of backed off Reagan for a couple of reasons. One is because, again, there was some sense about his capacities, about whether he really knew what people in the administration were doing in his name in this scandal, which, for any listeners who don't remember the Iran-Contra scandal involved trading arms with the Iranian government to try and free hostages in the Middle East, and then using some of the profits that were generated from those arms sales to fund anti-communist rebels in Central America, even though Congress had acted to ban the funding of those anti-communist rebels. So so there was that. The other thing is Watergate was still a very fresh memory for the American people. And the idea that we could have yet another failed presidency after Richard Nixon, plus after the Ford and Carter presidencies, which didn't end in anything like resignation or impeachment, but were considered failed presidencies for different reasons. Americans just so desperately, I think, in the 1980s, wanted a president to succeed. And so even at the time, I think there was a tendency to take the really serious constitutional abuses of the Iran-Contra scandal and try and kind of downplay them. But the impact of that today is it's almost completely forgotten. And one of the results of that, which I find ironic, is that Reagan is invoked now as somebody who would have known how to deal with Middle Eastern terrorists or would have taken a tough stand on Middle Eastern terrorists, when in fact, he was trading arms with the government of Iran to try and free hostages, which I think would be political suicide for any major politician today. So,
how have we mythologized Reagan's role in the end of the Cold War?
I think we've definitely overstated it. I mean, quite simply, that the myth is that the Soviet Union collapsed because we outspent them because they were afraid of our missiles. When I think really ultimately the reason the Soviet Union collapsed was because they coveted our computers and our technological advances. I think the things that caused communism to collapse over in Russia were largely driven by more by economic factors. Most experts who looked into it have said that increases in military spending, such as the one that Reagan carried out in the early years of his presidency, really tended to strengthen hardliners in the Kremlin and not the reformers. I think where Reagan deserves some credit, and I don't think this is what ended the Cold War, but I think Reagan does deserve credit for recognizing that Mikhail Gorbachev, when he arrived on the scene in 1985, was a reformer that he could work with, that he could do business with, and that what he successfully pursued with Gorbachev was plan to reduce the number of nuclear weapons, which was unprecedented at that time. And you did see a major arms agreement, which reduced an entire class of nuclear weapons from Europe, the intermediate-range missiles. And you also saw the beginnings of the so-called START Treaty, which was a more significant reduction of longer-range strategic nuclear missiles. So that's not what caused the Berlin Wall to fall, and that's not what ended the Cold War, but I think Reagan deserves credit for that. But I think ultimately communism and the Soviet Union collapsed of its own weight. I mean, I think Gorbachev realized that the Soviet system needed major reforms to stay current in the 20th century, and when he undertook those reforms, it started a cascading series of events that led communism to collapse. It's interesting that when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, USA Today did a survey of American people and also people in Germany right afterwards. And even in America, when they were asked, who do you think is responsible for the Berlin Wall coming down, the biggest answer by far was Mikhail Gorbachev. 43% of Americans said it was Gorbachev's, because of Gorbachev that this happened. Only 14% said it was Ronald Reagan. And yet today, I'm sure those numbers would be greatly reversed if you asked Americans today, because I think of the success of the myth-making. By the way, in Germany, only 2% credited Ronald Reagan. So I think there's a lot of mythology there. Like I said, I do think Reagan deserves some credit for his nuclear weapons policies, which were a lot more liberal than people realize. But I think it's a great overstatement to say that he won the Cold War. I don't think that's accurate.
Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak to Brian. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wish those 65 historians who, in the newspaper over the weekend, said that the Reagan's number 10 had read your book. I think his rating would be a lot lower among them. I'm really happy with this program. The only criticism I have is the use of the word myth. Let's just go ahead and call it what it is. Untruthfulness or lying is what I would prefer. That one of the things that Reagan did was started the whole idea that if you repeat a lie often enough and claim it as truth, then it will be. And you saw that with George W. Bush when he was running for governor. One of his big things was tort reform, that it would reduce everybody's insurance rates, when all the insurance analysts were saying, no, it will raise it. And that's indeed what happened, was that our insurance went up. And then, you know, after 9/11, every answer was 9/11. So
yeah.
I guess I would like for you to address the whole idea that under Reagan, the idea that if we repeat it often enough, it'll become true. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think one of the things that was really the most powerful and most significant about Reagan's presidency in the long run was his ability to use symbolism. I mean, you have to remember that the concept of the photo op, which is so deeply ingrained in our politics today, was invented by Ronald Reagan and his advance teams. I mean, these were the people who came up with the idea of coming up with these glorious backdrops and glorious settings. And your caller is right. There's one scene I describe in the book where Reagan's advance people found the most picturesque fishing village in eastern Maryland for Reagan to go out for an afternoon and talk about his environmental policies. When actually his environmental policies, were very destructive, including to Chesapeake Bay itself. But that's not the picture that was conveyed. Reagan's advance people had a saying, HPS, headline picture story, which meant that anytime they planned an event, they tried to envision what was the headline they wanted to get in the newspaper. What was the picture they wanted to run with the story, and what was the story? How did they want it portrayed? They were very successful in this. They understood the limitations and the abilities of nightly network newscasts, which was the main way that Americans got their news during the 1980s. And one thing I think is an unintended consequence of all that is I think that the Reagan administration was so great at delivering these photo ops and delivering these sound bites like tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev, that these sound bites live on today. One thing I talk about in the book, Tear Down This Myth, is how whenever you see a retrospective on TV of the 1980s, they'll show Reagan going, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," and they'll cut immediately to the people in Berlin on top of the wall celebrating, cause and effect, even though it didn't really happen that way. So,
how much time do you think has to pass before we can realistically assess any president's effectiveness?
Good question. Like I said, I mean, we're still debating Abraham Lincoln, right? So,
well, he comes out ahead now, I think.
Yeah, so, I think that's true, and it's unusual for a president to reverse. Although, I remember as a child, or growing up in the 70s when I first started paying attention to these things, that Harry Truman had been kind of unpopular and didn't run for another term in 52 had very low approval ratings, became hailed as his hero in the 1970s, that he'd been a leader with a great conscience. So I don't know. I'm doing an online event this week, the Talking Points Memo, which is a popular political blog, has a book club that I'm doing this week, and I just posted something there just wondering, the Reagan myth seems to be becoming so entrenched. Clearly the election of Barack Obama and a Democratic majority in Congress did not remove the Reagan myth from American politics. Like I said at the outset of the show, I mean, we saw it so dramatically in this debate over economic stimulus and how much of it should be tax cuts. You have not only just a Republican element in Congress, but also a lot of the pundits in Washington. The people who are so influential in determining how the news is delivered to us, are people who came of age during the Reagan years, and their idea that Reagan-inspired approach is what works politically is still entrenched with these people, even despite Obama's success and despite polls that people do want a more active role for government, in opposition to Reaganism.
So you don't see the Republicans moving away from the Reagan legacy at all in what may be the age of Obama now as we move ahead?
Certainly not in the next 4 years. No, I don't. I mean, I think... my gut instinct is that they're going to spend the next 4 years trying to find a presidential candidate that they can portray as the reincarnation of Reagan. I think there's some people in the party who think they found that in Sarah Palin, which is interesting. But if not her, perhaps somebody else. Now if that candidate, goes up in flames politically, will they be able to reassess? Come up with a new approach then? I don't know. But I think right now, despite their failures in the last two elections, I think Republicans are still looking for another Ronald Reagan.
Will Bunch's new book is called Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. Will, really interesting hour. Thank you so much.
Oh, Chris, thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.